This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Margaret Bauer had what many would consider an idyllic childhood. She was raised in a restored plantation house in southern Louisiana right on the bayou, spent most of her time with her feet in the water or her nose in a book. Margaret came from a long line of notable figures, including state politicians and renowned attorneys. So her name often preceded her, and Margaret just wanted to fit in. She eventually landed in Tennessee for graduate school, and it was there that she could finally be herself. She dug deep into Southern literature and went on to make a name for herself as a scholar who focuses on rebellious literary women. Margaret served as the editor for the North Carolina Literary Review for 20 years and recently won the North Carolina Award for Literature. She's also a professor of English at ECU, and Margaret Bauer is on my guest today on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And congratulations for winning the North Carolina Award.
Thank you very much. It's been quite an honor.
Well, we're going to find out how you got there, and we're going to start with your upbringing in Franklin, Louisiana. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a place very small. I call it a dot on the map at the bottom of the state. It's Cajun country now, although it was settled by Germans and British. And so most of my friends were French, of French descent. And we, as you said, we lived on a in a plantation home with 7 acres of land on the Bayou Teche. And we played outside. Even though it's very hot in Louisiana, we played outside. We made up games. We had a playhouse. We played in the barn. We climbed trees. We skied in the bayou. We've been swimming. I've been swimming since I was about 2. And we ate really good food.
All good. And you had a fairly well-known family, a family with a legacy, right?
I did. My grandfather on my father's side was in the House of Representatives when Huey Long was governor, and they were huge enemies. And the story goes that he was among Huey Long's hit list. Uh-huh. And my great uncle, who was his law partner and devoted brother, actually got a bunch of hunting buddies once and went to the state capitol and surrounded my grandfather and walked him out of the capitol.
Wow.
To kind of show Long that if he's on your hit list, be very careful before
hit
him. Yeah. He's got a lot of friends. Walked in there with their hunting rifles.
Wow.
So that was a legend in our family.
Your grandmother, also a legend. Tell us about her.
She was an icon. Her name was Margaret Worcester Bauer. Obviously, I was named for her. She practiced law. She got a law degree from Tulane in the 1920s. And she practiced in the same building as her husband and his brother, but she did not join their firm. She worked under her maiden name, Margaret Worcester. She voted for the first time at the beginning of the voting.
Wow.
The story about her that I heard is that when her father was raging about women being given the right to vote, she listened during lunch and then stood up from the table and he said, "Well, where are you going?" And she said, "To vote."
I got some friends here with rifles. No, that's the other story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How unusual would that have been? I mean, my assumption would be that a woman in the 1920s in the American South becoming a lawyer would have been a pretty difficult task.
I would imagine challenge. So. My father had a picture of the law class, and she was not the only woman I was surprised to see in the picture. But yes, it was unusual. It always surprised me when I did the math and realized when she got her degree.
Did you know her?
She died when I was 6. Mm. I have a vague memory of her, but lots of stories.
What about your sense of identity at the time? I mean, again, you're sort of growing up in the swamp, swimming. It's the water you're swimming in, the air you breathe. So you may not have a sense of yourself as Southern or particularly privileged. Did you at the time?
I think I knew we were privileged. That was part of how I didn't quite fit, like I felt like I fit in a lot. But I didn't know I was Southern. I didn't. It was the plantation house. It was my father's law career, and he was a politician too. That's what distinguished me more than I didn't think of any of us as Southern. I didn't find out I was Southern probably till I went to graduate school and started studying Southern literature.
Hey, that's me. Well, did you have a sense of identity? Did you feel Cajun? Did you have a sense of some form of regional identity or not yet?
Louisiana and my family. I actually felt kind of apart from the Cajuns. They were Catholic. We were not, though we went to Catholic schools, so that distinction was there always.
Yeah, but you went to, was it a Presbyterian Methodist Church?
Methodist Church,
your,
right.
Your mother had a
right. My mother, we had religion class every day, and so on Fridays we went to Mass, and we could, once we were in high school, we didn't have to go to Mass if we weren't Catholic, but my friends were going to Mass, so I went to Mass. So on Sunday, sometimes I would say, oh, come on, I don't need to go to church, I've been to Mass, and my mother said, damage control.
get thee to a Methodist church.
Yeah.
Well, talk about this business of fitting in. Again, it's a notable family. Your name is well known everywhere. Are stories about family members, and yet you felt the need to want to fit in, or like you didn't fit in. Where didn't you fit?
My ambitions, and I think that the older I got, the more that started to manifest itself. I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. That's what I was told I wanted to be my whole life because I was Margaret Bauer, and so I was supposed to follow my grandmother's footsteps. And so that wasn't going to be usual. And graduate school certainly wasn't usual. The idea of having a career and that career came first started to make me feel kind of like an outsider there.
You were thinking you wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah, I actually did want to be a teacher. Ever since I can remember, I liked to play school. I taught swimming lessons in the summertime. I just liked teaching. And I just assumed I'd be a lawyer because that's what, as I say, I was told I was going to do. But when I got to college at LSU, I double majored in English, which was appropriate for pre-law, and English education so that I could get certified to teach because I really did want to go back. And I assumed I would go back and teach high school because I didn't know anything that I could be a college professor. You know, I was a girl. And no one said to me, you can go to graduate school and become a college professor.
Your parents got divorced toward the end of your high school career, and that, I understand, had an effect on how you understood your mother after that.
Yes. My mother, they've split up at the end of my sophomore year, and then at the end of my junior year, my mother moved to New Orleans to pursue an art career. And she had gone back to school and gotten another degree. And In the distance, when we would visit, we would have long talks. And she had been very quiet when I was growing up. And so it was nice to kind of get to know her. The more she pursued her art, the probably happier she was. And so we became very, very close friends. And she also, in looking back, I realized she was always an artist. We had the dining room chairs were needle-pointed by her. Prom dresses were made by her. The curtains and bedspread in my bedroom, the quilts in my sister's bedroom, all of this were things that she made for us in all the years that we were growing up. And it was the artist in her. And she drew this, a lot of the things that she ended up needlepointing. And I still have a needlepoint print, a picture of my two cats that she drew and then needlepointed.
You're describing, of course, artifacts that we associate with very traditional domestic activities. But then you're saying your mother goes to art school. And was it a revelation to you that she had this, that this is art, that this is really her? It's not necessarily a duty to do these things. This is an expression of who she is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the more I got to know her, the more I realized that she is an artist. Mm. That is who she is. And she also loves to talk about my work, her work. She moved to Asheville about the same time I moved to Greenville, and she really thrived as an artist in Asheville.
So you decide to go to college, right? And you've got this kind of, you're going to try to please everybody and get into pre-law, but in your hip pocket, you're ready to teach. And then you go to grad school. Tell us about that. When you went to college, when did you first actually fall in love with Southern literature? When did that begin?
I had a class in college where we read Faulkner, and I just loved it. I didn't quite understand it, but I loved the literature. I loved his sentences. I loved his descriptions of the South, and I loved his exploration of these people. So that's when I fell in love with Southern literature. And then I only went to graduate school the first time by accident. I had a job lined up as an English teacher at a high school in Lafayette, Louisiana. I'd moved there after I graduated. But in the meantime, I went with a group from LSU to Paris for the summer. And when I got back, the job had fallen through. The woman I was supposed to replace, her husband didn't get transferred. She didn't leave. And it was August, and the only job I could find was a junior high all-girls school, Catholic school. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. So I thought, well, okay. I went over to the graduate, and I got in. And they needed someone who could teach right away. And since I'd done student teaching, I could do that. And so there I fell in love with literature. And there I had a mentor, Jim Wilson, at University of Louisiana now. It used to be University of Southwestern Louisiana, who pulled me in his office and said, you can finish your master's degree here, but then you need to go and get a PhD elsewhere.
Did that surprise you to hear that?
Well, people in Louisiana don't usually tell you to go. Mm-hmm. People stay. I'm one of very few people. When I went home for my, 25th or 30th high school reunion, I was one of very few who had left Louisiana.
But that meant he recognized something in you and that you had real potential and to get this PhD and teach, that mm-hmm. literature was your thing.
Which is what I wanted to do.
So right. So first of all, there's the bit of a surprise about asking anybody to leave because we're all homebodies here in Louisiana. But then this recognition in you that someone else had, did that surprise you?
No, my parents were very supportive. Yeah. Yeah. My whole life they have told me I was special.
You fell in love with literature and you also fell in love with a man at this time and you ended up getting married and that relationship was also revealing to you.
Well, I was married when I was in college, right after college or shortly after. And it was what you did after college. And it was a mistake. I think I wanted to be more part of the community. He was Cajun. He had a big family. He was like most of the people that I went to school with, and I kind of wanted to be part of that, and I never felt entirely part of it. But we really were not compatible. My ambition didn't quite suit, our life there. I couldn't have done what I've done. So when Dr. Wilson told me that I needed to go, I kind of took that opportunity to leave everything and went to applied and got in at University of Tennessee and left my life there.
And talk about that, your time at Tennessee in grad school. What were you doing there?
That's when I really started to focus on Southern literature. When I first got there, it reminded me, first I was very lonely. It was the first time I was in a place where I didn't know anyone other than when I was a kid at camp. I used to go to camp in North Carolina, Western North Carolina, and I had always said I was going to live in North Carolina someday. So, it soon reminded me of camp, that when I would go, I fit in better. The other girls at camp were more, had ambitions like me. They enjoyed reading as I did. And I loved it. And so once I moved to Tennessee, I realized, this is like camp.
There's stuff I can do, and there's people who agree
with
me.
And we had such a supportive group of graduate students at the University of Tennessee in the English department. And my mentor was when we talk about her, Dorothy Skura, my friends always say they have mentor envy. She was the best mentor a person could have. The first day I met her, when I was on campus right away, they introduced us, said, Margaret wants to study Southern literature. Dorothy was a Southern scholar. And so they told me, she asked me right away, what do you want to do your dissertation on? And I said, I think Faulkner. And she said, do you ever want to graduate? No, that's your second book. what else? Uh-huh. And she was right, by the way. Faulkner was my second book. But I said, I've discovered this new writer, Ellen Gilchrist. She writes about Deep South Mississippi and Deep South Louisiana. And I really love her stories. And Dorothy said, but she's still living, and that's really dangerous to write about a living writer. But the next day, Dorothy came up to me. She had stopped at the bookstore on her way home from work and picked up a copy of Gilchrist's short stories and read them that night. That's the kind of mentor she was. She walked up to me the next day and said, I read Gilchrist last night, and yes, I think you should. You'll write the first book on Ellen Gilchrist.
What was it about Ellen Gilchrist that attracted you?
Alan Gilchrist has these characters. The prototypical one is Rhoda Manning, and she is an ambitious girl, wants to be a writer, and her father likes that and is not quite sure what to make of it because Rhoda doesn't behave like a lady all the time. and of course, these characters are more my mother's generation, mm-hmm. And it starts post-World War II, kind of Rhoda's a child starting to stretch out against the limitations against women. And she's got an older brother who is allowed to do these things, but not her. And so I think I identified with that.
Well, we are foreshadowing here because this will become a theme that becomes very important to you, these outlandish women, these women who go beyond the borders. One of them could be Scarlett O'Hara if you liked that book, but you didn't, Gone with the Wind.
No, well, I didn't read it.
There you go.
When I was in the eighth grade, our history teacher / football coach took us to see Gone with the Wind when it was making its last rounds through theaters at our little tiny theater, the Tesh Theater in Franklin, Louisiana, to see the movie before it was going to cable. And I saw the movie, and I did not like the way it ended. So when I got home, I got the little library ladders to climb up to the top of the bookshelves in the den where my mother's Gone with the Wind was, and pulled it down and read the last few pages to see if it ended any better, and decided it didn't. So I thought, well, I'm not reading that. And when I was in graduate school, I was preparing for the first Southern literature exam for my subject exam that Tennessee would give, and we were working on my reading list, and Dorothy said, well, of course, Gone with the Wind. I said, oh, no, I can't read that. I was traumatized as a child.
Oh, just too long. But go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, I said, I can't. I was traumatized by Scarlett as a child. I can't. And she said, well, you have to read Gone with the Wind if you're taking a Southern literature exam, if you're going to be a Southern literature scholar. So I read it, and I was devastated by the ending. And so I just kept reading it because it's kind of what I do with literature a lot. If I'm not happy with the ending, but I really love a character, I need to read it until I know they're going to be okay. And I just kept rereading, and I've decided Scarlett's going to be just fine.
What is it that you read in the subsequent readings that convinced you of that?
Well, I think what the movie doesn't get at is how strong Scarlett is and how incredibly devoted she is to her family and her community.
In a much larger family, more children in the book.
Right, yeah. Right. She has the three children. She's not the greatest mom in the world, but she's a great provider. She's just not a mommy. And they have Melanie. Scarlett's children are well nurtured by Melanie, so they're going to be fine. It's Scarlett who's making sure they all eat. She also, you know, yes, she married her sister's beau, but he married her too. So why isn't everyone mad at him? She did it to save the family. She Scarlett didn't want to be married again ever. Being a widow was freeing for her. But she knew that if her sister married him, they'd take that money and go buy pretty clothes. And she needed to pay the mortgage. So she does sacrifice herself for her family. I don't think people realize that. They think of it more as the femme fatale.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, Rhett is at the end of the novel, a broken alcoholic. And he's going backwards to Charleston to go embrace that old South that he and Scarlett used to mock, because he's devastated by the loss of his daughter. Very understandable. But she's going forward to Tara, where she will thrive again, as she always does when she goes to Tara.
So you're pretty confident she's going to be okay.
She's going to be fine.
We're going to talk about that and how that led to your understanding of women's voices in Southern literature when my conversation with Margaret Bauer, the editor of the North Carolina Literary Review and a professor of English at ECU. Our conversation will continue in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today talking to Margaret Bauer, a professor of English at ECU who has devoted her career to studying and celebrating Southern literature. In her scholarship, she looks at rebellious literary women from the South. She's also edited the North Carolina Literary Review for two decades now. Let's talk about this idea of you wanted your first book or your thesis to be about Faulkner. It was your second book. Tell us about your discoveries and sort of revelations about Faulkner, his reputation, and how you found, you know, our understanding of him was somewhat limited in some ways as the voice of the South.
Right. Once I was challenged about why I would choose Faulkner as a woman scholar, a feminist, why am I writing about this white male? And I said, well, he's a very interesting voice of the South. And they were kind of thinking of him as thinking of himself as the voice of the South. But I don't think Faulkner thought of himself that way. I think he knew very much he was telling a story. And I was interested in that story because I knew those men who were kind of liberal-minded but felt like they couldn't change things, they couldn't speak up. And I thought, yeah, you could. Mm-hmm. Please speak up. You need to speak up. You have the power. But then I looked at Faulkner with writers like Lee Smith and Toni Morrison and Ernest Gaines and to hear Zora Neale Hurston right. and Ellen Glasgow from his own era, those two, and then contemporary writers, to look at other voices of the South and how they were telling stories that in some ways echoed Faulkner's plot lines or character types, but then they would refocus and tell the story from the woman's point of view or from the African American's point of view, and you'd get a different take on it. And that, and so when you put all those voices together, then you get a much broader and fuller picture of the South.
And the description that you just laid out is, it seems to me, a more rounded view of things. It's easy enough to take a particular writer and say, well, they were flat and maybe unfair to particular, you know, the way they characterized African Americans, the way they characterized women, which may be true if you're telling a story from a point of view. But what you're saying is, well, why don't we let that story stand on its own, coming from the imagination of one writer, and then add it to Ernest Gaines and Zora Neale Hurston and Ellen Gilchrist. And now let's see what you think of the South, if you allow each of those writers to write in and express themselves in full throat.
Right, right. And then you find out the other stories that weren't told before, which is important. Also the other regions, that there's also not a South,
right.
because by including Lee Smith, for example, it's very different South, the Mountain South, than is the Deep South that Faulkner wrote about. And then Zora Neale Hurston takes you to Florida and that area. So you get a broader terrain, too.
Ernest Gaines, too. I mean, again, the African Americans tend to be monolithic if you look at some of the other literatures or writers that you're talking about, because that's maybe the way they perceive them. Then you look at Ernest Gaines, A Lesson Before Dying comes to mind, where the complexity of life for African Americans and the choices that many people in Louisiana in that case faced come to life in a way that those other writers couldn't possibly express.
Right. When I first read Ernest Gaines, he's writing about people I've known my whole life and grew up around. He's the same age as my father, but they were raised in very different ways.
So let me ask you, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but that's interesting to hear you say that. I was raised, I knew those people all my life. I grew up around folks like that who he is describing. When you read Ernest Gaines, is there a revelation? Do you suddenly see things that you never understood before?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
A Gathering of Old Men is my favorite Gaines novel, and the young woman in there who is trying to help and how patronizing she is, I don't think I would have recognized that as patronizing then. But he also, his own life is so interesting. He couldn't get an education past the eighth grade in Louisiana. He had to go to California. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that my father also came from a very poor background before he was adopted into the Bauer family. And that was why he was adopted. His mother couldn't afford to take care of him. And so, and yet he ended up with so much privilege and certainly a college education, a law degree. And Gaines had to go away, you know, get educated in California, and he comes back, and they both become these very successful men back in Louisiana. In fact, they both ended up for a while working at the same university, which was interesting.
Well, you left and worked at a university that was not in Louisiana either. You went to Indiana.
I did for a year. Before my job at ECU, I had a year position at Wabash College.
a men's school.
It was a boys' school, yes.
Yeah, well, tell us about that.
That was interesting. They hire one-year positions to replace sabbatical professors on sabbatical, and they want to hire in areas they don't have covered because it's a very small school, and this way they could offer these other classes. So there I am invited to teach at a all-male school outside of the South, and I'm asked to teach a class in women's literature and a class in Southern literature. And that was very – and there went my analogy, for example, when I teach a Charles Chestnut short story where I use Confederate flags on trucks and Confederate balls as the kind of analogy. And I'm in a place where there aren't Confederate flags on trucks, and there that I know of, there wasn't a KA fraternity. And so I had to kind of reposition my teaching of Southern literature.
You were also warned – this is interesting, too, because they said, now, you know, be ready for this. It's all boys. You know, boys will be boys, so they might pardon their sexist humor.
Yeah. I often had colleagues commenting to me that, I hope – you know, my students told this sexist joke. I hope they wouldn't say it. And tell it to you. And I said, they're very polite boys. They are not going to tell a sexist joke in my company. But why are you letting them tell it in your company? Would you let them tell a racist joke in your company? I mean, it's the same. Just because there's not a woman in the room doesn't mean they should be allowed to tell this joke anyway. I mean, stop them and explain that you are offended. A man is offended right. by this joke.
And how did they take that?
I think they took it pretty well. I mean, remember, I was only there for a year, so I didn't, I didn't have to worry about tenure.
They could give you the Indiana equivalent of bless your heart.
Yeah. They did also ask me about what it was like to finally be out of the South. Ah. That's how they always put it. Oh, how does it feel to finally be out of the South? And I said, well, you know, this is a rural community and doesn't really feel that different. And apparently that was offensive to say. Ooh. And so I asked, well, does that mean that you were offending me by saying finally out of the South? So that was interesting.
Did you politely remind them that Indiana was the birth of the KKK?
I did. Politely? Actually, I did remind them of that.
Well, then you make the transition to ECU here in North Carolina. What were your – talk about that transition and your impressions of North Carolina.
Well, that was funny. When I was coming in for the interview, I was reading a Fred Chappell book. I still remember that. I had looked at my bookshelves and said, okay, which of these writers are from North Carolina specifically? Because I'm being hired also to edit NCLR. And I was reading his story about the beard that keeps growing and growing feeling pretty surreal because I thought I was reading realistic fiction and all of a sudden it gets very surreal. But then I looked out of the window of the plane and there were no mountains underneath me. What I was seeing below me was something not unlike Louisiana. And I thought, what happened to the mountains? Did I get on the wrong plane? They told me not to go to Greenville, South Carolina. And come to find out, that would have been hillier. But I found out that all of North Carolina does not look like Camp Green Cove. And at first, I was a little disappointed about that. And when my mom moved to Asheville, I remember saying, that's not fair. I wanted to live in the mountains. But I dated a guy for a while who took me fishing, and once I realized that I was close to seafood and I know how to cook it because I'm from South Louisiana, and I was close to water, and I could go fishing, and I put my feet in the water, and I have a river place now that I write and look out over the beautiful Pamlico River. And
that all sounds pretty great. Your professional life is going well. You're feeling home. However, on your 40th birthday, you started to quiver a bit.
Well, it was actually my 39th birthday where I was very upset about still being single and some disastrous relationships. And I thought, oh, you know, this is home. And yet, you know. Right. What's my future going to be? And I think that's when I realized I wasn't going to have children, and I was fine with that. But I really, you know, was lonely. I had a slumber party for my 40th because I decided if 39 was bad, 40 was going to be really bad. So I wrote friends from each chapter of my life and said, my grandmother gave me some money for Christmas, my mother's mother. And I said, I will buy you plane tickets if you will come and get me through turning 40. And they came. I had my best friend from first grade on. Then I had a friend from LSU, a friend from the first time I went to graduate school in Louisiana, a friend from Tennessee, a friend from when I taught at Texas A&M for a couple of years, and then a friend who had been in Greenville when I first moved there, but she had moved away. And my mom. And we had a slumber party for a weekend in Greenville in my beautiful house that's close to the university that I love. And the second night, the night of my birthday, my friends from Louisiana had brought king cake and Mardi Gras beads because my birthday is in February. And we were sitting around the table. And I looked at those women and I thought, you know, if those women came all this way just because I asked them, then I must be pretty special. And one of them said, you need to create this here. And I said, well, there aren't really any women my age. I don't, you know, most of the women were the younger or older. And I said, I don't have any close friends here. And I'd had a bad relationship, but I just couldn't meet people. And they said, well, make it happen. And so I did. And I started looking for those friends that would take the place of the women I have all over the country. And I have now the Starlight Women. We meet every Thursday. There are eight of us now. We meet at the Starlight Cafe in Greenville on Thursday afternoon. We have only two drinks, and some of us eat dinner, some not. And it's a group of women from not just the English department, but art and geology and a businesswoman. And
let's talk about the group of women that you collected in your book, 2014, A Study of Scarlets, because that's a collection of women's voices in Southern literature. Tell us about that.
I thought I was going to write a book about the relationships between women in literature, but it kind of ended up focusing on Scarlett. I was returning to her and very interested in that rebellious female voice. And so I ended up doing Gone with the Wind, and then the first chapter is A Defense of Scarlett. And I really dig into the book and remind you to go back to the book and see what she accomplishes. And I looked at Ellen Glasgow's novel Barren Ground. Ellen Glasgow is a contemporary Faulkner. Probably Barren Ground's Dorinda is a prototype for Scarlett. Margaret Mitchell had read Barren Ground, but it's set a little later set kind of pre-World War I, post Reconstruction. I don't want to leave out, there was a chapter on Cold Mountain, one of my favorite North Carolina novels. Where I really focus on Ruby and Ada and that relationship. One of the things I like about Gone with the Wind is Melanie and Scarlett's relationship when the men are away and how productive they are together and what a great unit they are. And kind of an untraditional family. And then Ruby and Ada create that same kind of bond without the competition that Scarlett feels for Melanie. There's no competing over a guy or anything. It's more about Ruby teaching Ada to love the land and to love a life that's very different from the Southern belle-turned-Southern lady life that Ada left because she was not interested in. So that was very interesting to me. So then Glasgow and a novel people don't know, which is The Invented Life of Kitty Duncan by Eastern North Carolina writer Kat Meads. And that's the 1950s, 60s Scarlet. And when I first read that, I did what people do with Scarlet. I didn't like Kitty and thought she was a sociopath and had this negative response. And then I realized I was doing to her exactly what people do to Scarlett. And I just started back on page one and reread it and remembering that you're getting that whole novel from other people's perspective. And I reread it trying to look at, and what Kitty is doing is whatever Kitty wants to do. And other people are offended, but she is not offending them. She's not trying to hurt her mother by not being what her mother wants. She's just being who she wants to be. And I just fell in love with that novel.
So there's a real genealogy both before and after Scarlett that is worth exploring, and you do in the book. Tell us about editing the North Carolina Literary Review now 20 years. Tell us about the mission.
Yes, I'm working now on my 21st print issue. So that has been the career I never could have dreamed of. It's not what you're prepared for in graduate school, and I didn't know what I was getting into when I took it over 21 years ago, but I'm so glad I did. I call myself a writer groupie all the time. Everybody's heard me say it, and it's true. So I've met some of my favorite writers. They have sat in my living room and on my front porch and talked about literature after various events and gotten to know what an amazing community of writers North Carolina has.
What's the mission of the Review?
We are to preserve the literary culture of North Carolina, which is one of North Carolina's greatest treasures, and have it in a place, you know, a single volume a year. So now we're working on number 27. My missions have been focused on rediscovering forgotten writers. I really love to publish an article about somebody, whether he or she was famous in their day or not, but now someone has rediscovered and realized this is part of the treasure. And also my absolute favorite thing to do is publish new writers and then watch their careers go from there.
And all part of that same story of sort of adding the multiplicity of voices that adds up to a much more complete picture of who
yes.
we are. And
yes.
How we got here. Well, once again, congratulations on your award, the North Carolina Award for Literature. You're in good company, by the way. Phil Freelon, the architect, Loretta Lynch, former attorney general, all in that class.
Yes. That was quite a night.
Well, congratulations, and great to talk with you. So great to have you on the show. Margaret Bauer, thank you.
Thank you.
Margaret Bauer, the editor of the North Carolina Literary Review, a professor of English at ECU, and this year's winner of the North Carolina Award for Literature. You can find out more about our show and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.